Welcome to the Kindle Chronicles, the Friday podcast all about your Kindle. I'm Len Edgerly, and this is episode 343 on Friday, February 27th, 2015. Greetings from wintry downtown Denver. My sister Stephanie texted me this morning from Fort Myers, Florida, where she is enjoying a well-earned respite from Boston's record-breaking winter. Alexa tells me she will see a high of 70 degrees today with showers. Sounds very okay from here. My guest this week is Julie Monroe, editor-in-chief of Telluride, which offers a steady diet of news and views on ebooks, libraries, publishing, and related topics. She doesn't miss much, so I enjoyed catching up with her on a wide variety of topics, from Telluride's growth to comics to what she's seeing in coffee shops these days.
If large-screen smartphones were going to replace the tablet, I would assume that I would start seeing people working on their big phones, and I still don't see it.
For the first item of news, I'm going to offer you a riddle. Why is an effort to eliminate digital rights management, DRM, like going to the moon? The answer is maybe a hopeful one for those of us who have long believed that locking down ebooks to particular formats does nothing to thwart piracy but does inconvenience readers. The Electronic Frontier Foundation, that's a longtime digital rights champion, sees DRM as a much bigger problem than inconvenience for Kindle users. Its answer to my riddle comes in this quote from author Cory Doctorow, hired by the EFF to take point on what's being called the Apollo 1201 project. Quote, Apollo was a decade-long plan to do something widely viewed as impossible, go to the moon, Doctorow said in an EFF release on January 20th. He continued, quote, lots of folks think it's impossible to get rid of DRM, but it needs to be done. Unless we can be sure that our computers do what we tell them and don't have sneaky programs designed to take orders from some distant corporation, we can never trust them. It's the difference between yes, master, and I can't let you do that, Dave. That last phrase is an inexact quote from the 1968 movie 2001: A Space Odyssey. Here is the actual statement, creepily voiced by the HAL 9000 computer in response to astronaut Dave Bowman's request to open a hatch.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me.
And so it goes. This was an eye-opener for me, and if the DRM issue interests you, I urge you to check out the full statement from the EFF via the link that I'll have at thekindlechronicles.com. The 1201 reference in the Doctorow-led initiative refers to Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which generally prohibits unlocking software access controls, including DRM. The Electronic Frontier Foundation believes that Section 1201 of the federal law also, quote, put a dangerous chill on security researchers who face potential legal penalties for finding and disclosing critical flaws in systems from smartphones to home automation. As a result, the public gets to find out about compromising vulnerabilities too late or not at all. I think that Cory Doctorow is a good choice to lead this project because his passion is paired with an eerily articulate and persuasive mind, which I remember from his visit to this podcast a year ago. He's basically unstoppable, and for this effort, that will be a very useful quality. Next in news, we've been hearing for a while that the number of independent bookstores in the U.S. has been rising in recent years following the collapse of the Borders chain. It turns out that trend is a contrast with what's happening to indie bookstores in the U.K., Ireland, and France. The New York Times on February 25th reported this story and noted that more than one-third of independent bookshops in Britain and Ireland in the past decade have closed, and the downward trend continued last year when about 50 more bookshops closed. By comparison, the American Booksellers Association here in the U.S. reports that the number of bookstores has risen by 27% since 2009. In France, where national laws try pretty specifically to make it difficult for Amazon to compete, the number of independent bookstores has risen, then dipped since 2009, with an overall trend only slightly upward, an increase of 5%. I'm sure there are many factors affecting the number of bookstores in different countries, but I do find it ironic that in the U.S., where Amazon probably faces the least amount of regulation and government protection of bookstores and publishers, the indie bookstore sector is doing better than in the countries where there is more protection. Part of the difference may be the robust championing of bookstores by their trade group in the U.S., the ABA, which I usually don't agree with, but I have to admire for its fierce defense of its members, bookstores. The ABA disappoints me in its fairly transparent use of Amazon as a whipping boy to generate support for the organization. But I know from my own experience that's the nature of associations like this. When I was in Wyoming 20 or 30 years ago, I worked briefly for a conservative nonprofit funded by the energy companies, partnered with ranchers who shared a common fear and loathing of the environmental organizations. And all we had to do in that setting was mention two words, Sierra Club, and the membership dollars would come rolling in. That organization did some good as well, as does the ABA. It's not clear what sort of lifespan is ahead for Barnes & Noble. I see they're splitting off the college bookstores but keeping the beleaguered Nook division. If that chain goes the way of Borders, perhaps there could be another period of growth in the number of independents, which would benefit a lot of communities where indie bookstores are key centers for culture and the love of books. Another news story this week features one of the last major books not available in ebook format, but this time there's a twist. The Associated Press on February 20th reported that the estate of Malcolm X has finally authorized a digital edition of the book written with Alex Haley. That's the autobiography of Malcolm X, and that was first published in 1965, shortly after the activist was killed. What's more, the ebook will be self-published, bypassing the publisher of its paper editions, Ballantine Books, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. A spokesman for Ballantine offered what I thought was a graceful comment to the AP, saying, quote, "While we would be honored to be asked to publish an ebook edition, we are aware and respectful of the estate's interest in publishing the work as an ebook under their own direction." The AP noted that with recent ebook versions of books by Harper Lee and Ray Bradbury, the number of major works not available in ebooks has shrunk to just a few, with the most prominent being J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye and Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude. In another bit of publishing news, Amazon this week announced that it will release the first set of 10 Kindle Scout reader-selected books next month. A Christian Science Monitor story that I found suggests that this program might be thought of as American Idol for books, or the democratization of publishing, or maybe the crowdsourcing of literature. But by whatever name you want to call it, this first batch of books is going to include science fiction, romance, thriller, and mystery genres. I really enjoy the way Amazon has set up this Kindle Scout project. If you navigate your browser to kindlescout.amazon.com, you will see books that you can nominate for publication by Amazon based on a sample that you can download to your Kindle device or app. One that I nominated, Housebroken by The Berg, is not among the 10 to be published next month. It'll probably come in a later wave, so my free copy of that book is not available yet. Two others that I nominated were not chosen in the November selections. At the Kindle Scout site, I can see my past nominations to see how they're doing, as well as my current nomination of a sci-fi thriller in which an MIT professor tries to save humanity from a nuclear holocaust by going back in time. The sample that I read had more typos and common cliches than I like to see, but the story grabs you quickly, and I can imagine it might be selected for publication, maybe with some editing help along the way. The title is Parallel Relativity by Kalen Hunter, and you will find a link to it in the show notes if you'd like to join me in giving it a boost with a nomination. If a book that you nominated gets selected, you get a free copy, and I think you get an advanced copy. So you get just a slight little bit of recognition of the fact that you've helped nominate a book that's going to be published. But for what you invest in reading the sample, I think it's a pretty good trade-off and a lot of fun. Kindle Scout is akin to the crowdsourcing Amazon does for Amazon Studios, where customers leave feedback on pilots for proposed TV series, and that information goes into deciding which shows to greenlight for first or renewing seasons. This seems to be a smart way to take advantage of the huge Amazon customer base and to involve customers in an enjoyable link with creators of content, whether video or book. Amazon looks like it must be pleased with how the initial Kindle Scout nominations went, because they are opening up the program to more genres, adding contemporary fiction, which I'm glad to see, also historical fiction and action and adventure. What, no poetry? Now, wouldn't that be something? And finally, in news this week, a software update to the Fire HD 6 and HD 7 tablets enables them to use Firefly. That's the visual search product tool that made its debut last year on the Fire Phone and then on the Fire HD X 8.9. I don't think Firefly is as handy on a tablet as it is on my phone, because the real advantage of Firefly is seeing something out and about that you want to capture information on, like a poster for a concert or a book someone's reading or a QR code for just about anything. But since the number of Fire phones in use is admittedly pretty limited, certainly far fewer than the number of HD tablets, especially the very popular HD 6, this update will introduce Firefly to lots of new users. Maybe they'll start liking Firefly so much they'll think, boy, I sure wish I had a phone that would do this. Then there go the sale of the Fire phone. Speaking of the Fire Phone, I want to say it appears that I'm going to face my big decision regarding whether to return to the iPhone platform from the Fire Phone pretty soon. Apple announced a big press event for the Apple Watch set for March 9th, and it's going to be very tough for me not to be one of the first to try out this big new launch by Apple. I did, however, spot a possible way to stay attached to the Fire Phone, which I really do love, and still test this digital watch realm via an exciting startup named Pebble. This is the company which raised more than $10 million in a Kickstarter crowdfunding campaign in 2012, and it has sold a million of its e-paper watches. These are black and white watches, the first generation. As big footsteps sound on the earth from the approaching Apple Watch, Pebble launched another Kickstarter campaign recently for its new model, which will feature a mysteriously sourced color e-paper screen. It doesn't look like it's made by E-Ink, the company in Massachusetts. It's some other supplier that's finally making a color e-paper that is going to be used for this. What works for me is that Pebble can sync with iOS or Android, so there is at least a chance that I will be able to download the Android app from Google Play to my Fire Phone using the One Mobile Market app and a .apk file. I'd say this works at least half of the time. So I ordered a first-generation Pebble watch to try it out, and it's scheduled to arrive here in Denver on Monday, March 2nd. I also entered a pledge for the new version named Pebble Time, but by the time I heard about it, the best Kickstarter deals were all taken, offering bigger discounts on the scheduled retail price of $199. I'm in for $189 and delivery in June. What really cranked up my hopes for Pebble the most was a long article by Stephen Levy, a legendary tech journalist known for his coverage of Apple and Steve Jobs back in the day. He's now hanging out at Medium.com, the what's next after Twitter invention of Twitter co-founder Ev Williams. Levy visited Pebble founder Eric Mijakovsky, a disarmingly calm and pleasing entrepreneur, the day after Apple announced its watch on September 9th of last year. I arrived early so as not to be trampled by a rush of employees seeking to divest stock options, Levy wrote in his delightful report at Medium. Mijakovsky, Levy continued, looked pretty chipper for a broken man and bounded into the office, quote, with a hop in his step and his usual puppy dog smile. Okay, I told myself, he's Canadian. He can't help smiling. Levy followed with this. Whether delusional, maniacally focused, or simply well-rehearsed, Midzhikovsky chose to view the Apple announcement as a plus for Pebble. "It's pretty incredible to see the world's largest company come into the watch space," he said. "It's validating something I've known for the last 6.5 years, that the next generation of computing will be on your body." So we'll see. I hope I can connect my Fire Phone to Pebble's Android app, and even better, that Amazon might convince them to develop an app that straight up works with the Fire instead of requiring a dicey workaround to download the D.apk file. What you may hear right now is someone whistling in the dark, a last gasp of loyalty to this hapless Bezos invention, the Fire Phone, and come March 9th, I may not be able to resist the big, colorful, wrist-thumping beat of the Apple Watch. Of course, I do have 2 wrists and 2 pockets. This could easily get ridiculous. For the tech tip this week, I want to tell you about a handy tool for transferring ebooks to your Kindle library. It's called KindleBox, and it connects a Dropbox folder to your Kindle and sends books and other readable files over automatically. There is a good description of the procedure at thenextweb.com by Amanda Connolly, and you can start using it at kindlebox.me. Pretty good directions on how to do it. I'm not sure why this is more convenient than using the Send to Kindle app on your computer, so I'm going to spend some time trying it out. One thing it maybe you can share with more people, but if I understand it right, everyone's going to have to be attached to the same account to work with this Dropbox folder. So anyway, if you give it a try and have some thoughts as to the pros and cons of moving books to your Kindle devices using KindleBox versus Send to Kindle, let me know. You can send me an email at podchronicles@gmail.com. I tried it with Project Gutenberg. I found a book on Ecuador that was interesting. And at Project Gutenberg, you can drop things right into Dropbox. The only thing I had to do after doing that was to move it from the app's Gutenberg subfolder in my Dropbox account to the app's KindleBox folder. Pretty easy to do. They asked for a $10 donation, or they asked for different levels of donations. I made one for $10, so if you like it and you want to help them out, that would probably be a great idea. Under Julie Monroe's editorship, the digital publishing news site Telereed has seen steadily growing readership. When I spoke with her last in May of 2014, daily visits to the site stood at about 3,000, and now they are up to between 3,300 and 3,500, or well over 1,000 visits a month. I reached Julie at her home in Virginia on Monday, February 23rd, and she began by giving some background on this increased activity at Telereed.
One of the reasons we had the traffic we had is we had these two crazy performing posts all around watching Amazon Instant Video on Android tablets. Well, once Amazon released an official app, not surprisingly, the traffic on those posts went way down, but other posts have come along to keep it up. You know, I mean, every so often we just get weird spikes from things, but we've got some pretty good steadily performing how-to. Chris Meadows did a post on how to install CM11 on a Nook 7.
That puts a specific version of Android on the Nook.
Yep, it gives a vanilla Android KitKat.
There's no way to do that on a Fire device, I guess, is there?
Actually, there is. You can go to N2A, and that's a numeral 2.com. And if you're running the right version of Fire, it doesn't work on the newest Fires, but it works on the older Fires. And yes, it basically wipes out the Amazon forked version and replaces it with a clean version of KitKat.
Why might someone want to do that?
If they wanted to be able to easily install Google Play without doing a lot of workarounds.
Right.
Now, here's the downside. You lose the ability to download Amazon Prime videos. You can still install the Amazon Instant Video app, but there will be no downloading.
Oh, that's right. Yep. And it also wouldn't work on the newer Fires.
And it does not, or at least it didn't the last time I checked, which was about 3 or 4 months ago. They may have updated it for the newer Fires. I don't know.
Yeah.
But basically, it's wiping it out. It's wiping everything out and starting fresh. So if you're not into dealing with that. If you want your tablet to just work, yeah, don't do this. I've had issues since I did it on my Nook 7 and my Nook HD. It works after a fashion most of the time.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about comics. I noticed that you confessed that you haven't been an avid reader of comic books or graphic novels, and that's my situation as well. It seems like it's a really hot part of the publishing world, that the sales of comics and graphic novels are increasing. So tell a little about your weighing into this world recently and what you've learned.
As I said in the Telluride article, I've always wanted to be a comic books fan, but when I sit down and add up the, you know, reading books dollars versus reading comic book dollars, yeah, it doesn't add up for comic books. So when Scribd said they were going to put comic books on, I was thrilled. There were four or five series I've been wanting to go back and read, but I didn't want to, you know, pop down $4.99 an issue. And as it happened, most of the ones I wanted are on Scribd.
What are some of the ones that you were hoping to read and you saw on Scribd?
I wanted to reread Angel After the Fall, and then there's a whole bunch of Spike comic books all based around the Buffy the Vampire character, not the My Little Pony Spike. Scribd does do a search by character, and you get some interesting results when you put in Spike. I was not expecting to see a My Little Pony. And Jim Butcher has a series of comics based on his Harry Dresdens, and I wanted to read those. And I've always been meaning to catch up on some of the Marvel, you know, the Avengers, Iron Man, X-Men. I've also have this bucket list to read all of the Batmans before I die. So somebody had better get those in a subscription or I'm going to be in trouble.
They're not on Scribd?
They only have Marvel. They don't have DC. So in my article, I kind of put in a plug for, guys, go talk to the folks at DC.
What else is on a bucket list that contains that interesting item?
Well, let's say I want a master's degree in something that I want that has nothing to do with my career, because I'm perverse that way.
So the master's degree just on a topic that wouldn't have any kind of practical use, but just because you want to learn about it.
Yeah, and I know what it's going to be. It's going to be social anthropology, which actually does have some practical application to my day job as a business coach, but the MBA would be the obvious one, and I'm like, yeah, no, I don't want to do that. One of these days, I'm going to get my master's in social anthropology.
Cool. How does Comixology compare with Scribd just in terms of a place to read comics? Now, Comixology is the one that was purchased by Amazon.
The biggest advantage that Comixology has over Scribd is the guided view, where it will basically, you can put it into a view where it will walk you pane by pane. So instead of seeing the whole page on your screen, you just see each pane. And I love that about Comixology, because I confess, I get lost in which pane to read next. I goof up all the time and end up having to go back going, wait, I think I read things out of order. So I like the fact that Comixology just walks you through. Plus, it blows it up so you can really focus on the art. And no, Scribd does not have that. Comixology has a patent for it. They could license it to somebody, but I don't know if they want to, because it does give them a huge competitive advantage. But beyond that, there's no real advantage to Comixology over Scribd. I mean, the comics look basically the same in the two apps, and if you don't mind giving up the guided view, there's no readability difference. I've used both apps. I also read some manga on Viz Manga. Again, no guided view. Yeah, as far as the reading experience goes, there's no downside to Scribd. There's only the upside of it doesn't cost you any extra to read as many as you want.
Now, I was trying to figure out if it was in any way a similar comics selection on Kindle Unlimited. So when I went into Kindle Unlimited and I just searched for comics, I think I came up with 50,000 titles. But it wasn't clear to me that they were really comic books. Some of them seemed to be like samples or... But have you compared or taken a look at what's available at Kindle Unlimited in comics?
No, because I don't currently have a Kindle Unlimited subscription. I subscribed for 2 months when it came out just to try it out and decided that while it had some advantages, I mean, I do like the fact that I can read them on my Kindle Paperwhite, the selection wasn't compelling enough for me. A lot of what they have is indie authors and Amazon publishing imprints. And you can get those at pretty decent prices because indie authors don't price themselves crazy. So I figure I'll buy those and use Scribd to read the stuff that's more expensive.
Now, and you also looked at Oyster. You're sort of, at one point, you were kind of considering the three main book subscription services. Was the comics the big reason that you ended up settling on Scribd?
No, because I've been with Skrid for more than a year. I tried Oyster the first month it came out. I don't like the app. I just don't like the interface. I don't like their themes. I like the concept of the themes. I don't like the specific themes. I couldn't find one that I was comfortable reading. And now that Skrid has audiobooks, there's way more to draw you to Skrid. I think it's a better value. Even, you know, and it's not the dollar less. I would pay more for Skrid than $8.99 a month because of all the stuff that they have.
As I've been experimenting with comics, I found one on Skrid. It was called March, and it was by Congressman John Lewis with Andrew Aiden. And it was kind of his autobiography in graphic novel form, you know, growing up and being active in the civil rights movement. And I have to say that even as I enjoy reading something like that, I feel like, well, this isn't really reading. This is like kids' stuff, or it's not literature. So I've obviously got some kind of bias against this form. But at the same time, I noticed that the drawings of this guy growing up in the South and all he went through and Selma and everything, they were conveying the story in a way that took far fewer written words to tell the story. And it made me wonder if the reason comics are seeing some real growth, it's better suited for this busy time-crunched age because it just takes fewer words to tell the story. I'm sort of puzzling through why I should be looking at this genre and what its advantages are.
It's the art. You know, you either like seeing the visual media or you don't. And I don't have the same bias. My mom grew up, she basically learned to read with comic books. So she never minded if I wanted to read things that weren't, you know, literature, because she couldn't really talk, and she basically learned how to read on Richie Rich. There's not much literary value in Richie Rich from what I remember from reading a few as a kid. But I like the art. I like the graphics. I like the sense of, especially action scenes with what's going on, and you can get, you know, character expression. I mean, it's like, you know, I guess watching a still movie. So it has a lot of the same advantages of the movie, but by using different thought bubbles, you can get into people's heads. You can see what characters are thinking, which you can't really get across in a movie without doing, you know, cheesy self-narration. So I like the mix of the visual media and the written. It makes for a really nice reading experience.
Are there people that are sort of pressing the format and coming up with things that weren't being done in comics 40 years ago and just doing really creative stuff?
Probably. Again, since I haven't been a big comics person, there's better people to ask for who's pushing the envelope. I confess, I mean, what I like is comic book adaptations of things that have been on TV. So I discovered that Skrid has a whole bunch of X-Files comics, and I'm like, I am all over that. So when it comes to comics, real serious comics people would probably look down on me and go, oh, she's so plebeian reading that stuff. But it's what I enjoy. So,
yeah.
You know.
So there'll probably be a Breaking Bad comics at some point.
I would be surprised if there weren't already one.
Well, another thing you've written about at Telluride recently is our love affair of tablets, and does declining shipments indicate that it's over for tablets?
Well, I read this article a year ago called Our Love Affair with the Tablets is Over, and I had a pretty strong negative reaction to it. But it's like, okay, you know, be rational. Tablet shipments were starting to dip even then. So what I did is I clipped the article into Evernote and set a reminder to look at it, revisit it a year later. So this is a year old article. And when I remembered that he had talked about big smartphones basically replacing tablets. And of course, we've got the iPhone 6 Plus, which I'm continually surprised at how many of those monsters I see in the wild. We've got the Galaxy Note 4. And I did a search this morning. There's plenty of Chinese companies selling 7-inch smartphones if you wanted to get a true giant smartphone. So I went back to read this article, and he gets to the end, and he's talking about being curled up on his couch with a 5-inch phone. And I'm like, 5-inch phone? That doesn't even count as a large-screen smartphone anymore. When I read the original article, I had an iPhone 4S, not the biggest screen. Now I have an HTC One M8, which is a 5-inch smartphone. And I do like the bigger screen. I do find web browsing to be easier. But it doesn't replace my tablet. I don't do anything on the phone additional that I used to do on my tablet. I still go to my tablet for reading, for video, and mostly for games, although the phone does make a fantastic Game Boy Advance emulator. Other than that, I don't play games on it.
And you've got a full-size iPad?
Yes, I do. And I toyed with getting a mini at some point, and then comics came out. And at 47, my eyes do not do very well with the small print. I can read on my full-size iPad without my reading glasses. If I try it on my Nook HD 7-inch, got to pull out the reading glasses. So there are things for which the tablet is just useful, and there are things for, for which this phone is useful. But this is me. I get that. So I've been looking at what I've seen out in the wild. I spend a lot of time in coffee shops, both writing there and meeting with clients. And 5 years ago, you saw laptops and notebooks. Gradually, laptops and notebooks were replaced by tablets. If large screen smartphones were going to replace the tablet, I would assume that I would start seeing people working on their big phones. And I still don't see it. I see people doing Facebook. I see people texting, obviously. But if I see people actually working, I see them on. I see a lot of people on tablets and a few on laptops. The tablets have largely replaced laptops as the device that people do work on. And one guy had a tablet, two phones, a book, and a laptop. I mean, this little table at Starbucks had so much stuff on it. It's like he couldn't. Yeah, there was no room for food. So I will believe that tablets are on their way out when I see lots of people doing work on smartphones at coffee shops, and I just don't see it yet.
When you see people working on tablets, how often do you see them hooked up to a wireless keyboard as opposed to just tapping on the tablet itself?
Most of the time they have a keyboard.
Yeah.
In fact, I remember it was like probably about 3 years ago I saw my first keyboard keyboard case, so it looked at a quick glance, it looked like he was working on a laptop, and then I realized he was working on an iPad. So I still remember seeing that for the first time and going, "Wow, that's cool!" And now I see them all the time.
Well, I would think that with the 6 Plus, I don't have a, you know, I've got the Fire Phone at this point, but wouldn't there be some possibility to have a nice keyboard that would fold up against the 6 Plus, and then you'd be there at your Starbucks, and you'd be doing the sort of working on your tablet, but with that 6-inch screen. I mean, I would think that would be kind of handier.
I think it could be done. You wouldn't even need a keyboard case. I have a standalone Bluetooth keyboard, the Amazon Basics. So it doesn't matter what device I have, that keyboard will work. I have pulled that thing out and typed an email on my phone using the keyboard.
Yeah.
Or I can use it on my with my iPad. So, no, there's no reason people can't do it, but I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
Even when I see a 6 Plus, someone's using it to check the internet, check Facebook. Good God, it's amazing how much time people spend on Facebook at coffee shops. Or occasionally they actually use the darn thing as a phone.
Huh.
I have sat down in one client meeting where somebody had a Galaxy 4, a Note 4. That is the only time I have ever sat across a table from somebody who had a smartphone instead of a tablet or a notebook to take notes in.
Interesting.
So we'll have to give it another year.
Yeah. Well, and then going sort of even smaller, do you plan on getting an Apple Watch when they're available in April?
I have no intentions of getting an Apple Watch, in large part because I don't have an iPhone anymore. When I went from iOS to Android, I kind of gave up the iWatch or Apple Watch or whatever they're calling it. I saw a headline. I didn't read the article. You know, it was something along the lines of, is there really any value in spending $300 to transfer information from one screen to another screen?
Exactly.
And I read that and went, yeah, that's pretty much how I see smartwatches. I have my Fitbit, and I love my Fitbit, but I have no desire to take a call or check my texts on my Fitbit or anything else on my wrist. Not that hard to pull my phone off my belt. It's just not.
Yeah. About the only thing that has struck me as pointing toward where this thing might have some impact is that business on the Apple Watch. If you have one and your partner has one and, you know, they're in Boston, you're in Denver, you can send them a message and they can be feeling your heartbeat on their wrist as just sort of a new way. My wife says that's to call that an improvement in intimacy is obscene, but
I'm freaking myself. But But maybe that's just me. I resisted video calls for a long time too.
Well, it's going to be fascinating. I mean, I fear that I'm going to give up my Fire phone so that I get back on an iOS phone so I can try the watch, and we'll probably be standing in line either in Denver or Boston to get one of these things. But it could be a huge flop. It when people realize that they're paying that much just to move data from their pocket onto their wrist. But I think the other thing that's unknowable at this point is what kinds of things might be thought up that would take advantage of this new platform.
Well, I confess, when the iPad came out 5 years ago, I was right there laughing at it. I was. I thought it was a ridiculous idea. There was no reason anybody would ever use this thing.
Yeah.
And now you'll, get it away from me by prying it out of my cold, dead hands. So, sometimes we don't realize the utility of something until we have it and realize the utility. So I could change my mind. I've looked at Android Wear watches. I've thought about it. But I stopped wearing a watch 4 or 5 years ago, and I've got no real desire to put something that big back on my wrist. My Fitbit's small. It doesn't do it for me, but then again, I kind of trust Apple. Of course, I also thought the Fire Phone was going to do well, so I'm the best prognosticator. I really thought the Fire Phone was going to do better than it did.
I suspect they're going to come out with a 6-plus size Fire Phone next, because it makes so much sense for them with all the video content and the books to have something that's that size. Bezos is stubborn. I think that he'll be making Fire Phone watches for the next 20 years, and at some point they'll probably come up with something that'll be a hit.
Probably. I trust him to come up with interesting things.
Well, let's finish up with your other. This you spend what would you say 3/4 of your time at your day job and a quarter on Telluride and another quarter as a fiction writer, which doesn't add up. But
that's pretty accurate. And yes, I know the math doesn't add up.
What are you working on your next book in the series with the warlock and the vampire?
Yes and no. A new draft. I just finished a new draft. A first draft of a new book. It is in the same universe, but does not. It has a different warlock main character. I'm doing kind of a spin-off series. And yes, my warlock and vampire from the original series do have a guest starring role, and my intent is to basically cross these two over and have characters from one show up in stories from the other. The reason I did this story is it's actually a rewrite of a novel I wrote 15 years ago. I was going to try to work it in as a warlock case files. It just didn't work. There was one scene that had to be done from third person, and my other series is in first person. And my personal philosophy on point of view is you don't switch point of view. If you start in first person, you stay in first person.
Right.
So this one scene had to be done in third person. So I said, fine, I'll go ahead. And I changed the main point of view character, made some changes, completely rewrote it. There's probably only 10% of the original words in it, but I've got a new character to play in. And since he is, there's no romance subplot in it. He's straight. My other two characters are gay. So it has the potential to bring in a different audience than people who might not like my gay warlock and vampire might be more comfortable with an older straight character.
When do you hope to have it available for people to purchase?
I'm hoping by summer.
Does it have a title yet?
Buried but Not Gone.
Cool. What will you price it at?
I'm trying to think. Probably $4.99.
Mm-hmm. And this will be Kindle Direct Publishing?
I'm torn between putting it in Select for 90 days and seeing what happens.
Mm-hmm.
And going, it'll eventually go wide. If I put it in Kindle Unlimited, it'll be for 90 days only. And it will also have print on demand. Since we spoke, two of my other novels are now CreateSpace, so they're in print as well.
How did that work out?
It was very straightforward, not a problem at all. It sounds like a bigger deal than it is. I just needed to have somebody. I needed to have my cover designer tweak it so that you could have a spine and a back cover. It was very straightforward.
I have been speaking with Julie Monroe, editor-in-chief of Telluride. Thanks very much, Julie.
Thank you.
After my conversation with Julie Monroe, I asked a Mayday tech if there is a way to search Kindle Unlimited just for comic books. Becky, the tech I spoke with, said there is not, but that she has heard that request from other customers and that she was going to pass along my request as well. I think this makes it difficult to know whether Kindle Unlimited's comics selection rivals that of Scribd, but it's probably a safe bet to assume that it doesn't. In content, I will have a link to a useful guide to books that are going to be published this spring and summer. It's a free ebook titled Buzz Books 2015, and it's the third volume in an annual series organized by Michael Cater of Publishers Lunch. He is one of the leaders of Digital Book World that I attended in January. We had him briefly on the show when I was in New York. He writes a good introduction to this series. Buzz Books 2015 lists books by genre, tipping the reader off to big books coming soon, and there are extensive samples of many of the books, so each one has a photo of the author and a brief introduction to that book, and then you can actually, you know, read quite a bit of it to get a sample of whether you think you'd be interested. As I read through it today on my Fire HD 6, a couple of things caught my interest. One is there's a book coming out by Milan Kundera. He wrote The Unbearable Lightness of Being. This one's called The Festival of Insignificance, due out from Harper in June. Robin Kerman looks at the effects of a murder on three Harvard friends. That's Bradstreet Cafe, coming out in April. Jeffrey Deaver has a new book, Solitude Creek, coming out in June. Stephen King's Finders Keepers is coming out in June. Unpublished stories from the late Elmore Leonard arrives with Charlie Martz and other stories from William Morrow in June. Neal Stephenson explores untold new worlds in Sevens's July, and that's in the sampler. I read a little bit of that. It was very compelling. It starts out with the moon blowing up, and then it goes on from there. So this is a great way. Oh, another one, David McCullough, the historian. My father loves all of his books. He's got one coming out, which is a fresh look at the brothers who invented the first modern airplane, and the Wright brothers. That's from Simon & Schuster in May. And Robert Putnam, who wrote Bowling Alone, he has a new book out that's coming out in March. So good place to get ideas for books that you might be looking for in the next few months, especially as you get into the great summer reading period. I've got some good shows lined up for you in the next several weeks. Next week, we'll sit down with Sarah Nelson, who is editorial director at Amazon.com, and she'll be talking about the best books of the month for March, which will be coming out in just a few days. After that, James McQuivey will return for another conversation about what he's watching in the world of digital media. And after that, I will be coming to you from South by Southwest in Austin. I'll be down staying with my cousin Peter and seeing what we can learn about digital publishing, books, and everything else at the Woodstock of the Internet. I've got one last thing, as Steve Jobs would say. A very interesting app came to my attention from Clammer, C-L-A-M-M-R, and a student at the Berklee School of Music in Boston tracked me down from the podcast. They call it an audio version of Twitter, and instead of 140 characters, you can post 18 seconds of audio at Clammer. And then anyone using the app, it's only available now on iPhone or iPad, can listen to it and then forward the clip by Twitter, Facebook, text message, or email to someone else. And what's great is along with that clip, they can attach a link to, in my case, the whole show. So I'm going to be experimenting with this, and if you want to try it, just download Clammer to your iOS device, and then if you browse for content, just enter the word Kindle, and Kindle Chronicles will show up. You'll see that I did one for last week's show, and I'd like to try doing this as a way to promote the show each week, where I'd have a little snippet from the show tied to a link to it, so it'll be fun to play around with. It looks as if it's being used a lot by musicians, and it seems like a smart way for a musician to get a little snippet of their work out there in a way that can be shared by fans and passed around. It's also, if you try the app, you'll see that you can search around for snippets of audio on all kinds of content. Darlene asked me to see if there was anything about quilting, and there really wasn't. So it's a fairly new platform, but hopefully it'll build out, and I think that we'll see if the Kindle Chronicles can't be part of it. February 27th is a big day in my life, especially this year. It's 30 years ago on this date is when I stopped drinking. So I haven't had a drink in 30 years today, and that was kind of a nice milestone. I was 34 years old at the time, and now I'm 64, so that's made a huge difference in my life. This is Len Edgerly in downtown Denver for the Kindle Chronicles. I really appreciate your taking the time to listen to my podcast. Have a great day. Bye.